I know that some of you wonder where the heck I come up with this stuff. In fact, someone just whispered in my ear, "You're crazy." I'm preaching a sermon series this year, not just one, but like seven of them, on stories that make no sense. And I swear there is rhyme or reason, one of the two, behind that choice. I know that there is something dangerous about religious concepts that are entirely too obvious, about constructions of faith and stories of faith where the lines are too easily drawn and the good guys are always clearly differentiated from the bad guys. Stories like that and ideas about religion like that are quite convenient when one is inclined to make war in the name of their faith. You know the sorts of stories that make way too much sense? The ones with clear rules and obvious points? Pray in the right way and you will achieve peace. Believe this particular thing and you will be rewarded while all others are punished. Infidels are bad. Only your particular leader is good. Mosques are terrible, etc., etc. Such religious stories, which often adhere with shocking accuracy to the plot of particularly bad Hollywood movies, give people the comfort of thinking they can structure the world according to such obvious plot devices. They give us ready answers. They tell us who the bad guys are and whether or not we are in fact on the team of the good guys. Such stories can be dangerous, and they are present in the more literalist and oversimplified forms of every faith tradition, including ours. There is something cheap, I think, about stories with crystal clear takeaway messages and characters with motivations so hard they could cut through glass. But those aren't the only kind of stories that religious people tell. So this year, I've chosen to invite us into an exploration of stories that challenge our assumptions instead of affirming our biases. Stories that throw us off a little rather than just confirm our long-held opinions. Unlike the movies, in real life, the good guy doesn't always wear a white hat. And the truth isn't always best reflected in a story that gives us a comfy glow at first glance. Because life is complicated, and people are complicated, because truth is multifaceted, the most honest stories we can tell often make us a little uncomfortable and require of us a second, a third, a fourth look until we see what wisdom there is inside them. The truly great religious leaders of all faiths have long known this. They have, in fact, used their teaching to fight against the obvious, to resist with all of their might the temptation to simply conform to people's expectations. For as long as charlatans have existed, so have there existed sages, storytellers for whom simple answers to complex questions come only at the end of a long journey of discovery. For ages, in every great religious tradition, mystical believers have been telling stories that don't make any sense, at least not at first. Buddhist koans are short little riddles meant to keep the listener pondering for years of their lives until finally the meaning of it becomes clear like the dawning of the first day. Rabbis across the ages have woven yarns that unsettle and create creative dis-ease, and shamans in every village on every continent have spoken in riddles that undermine the superiority of their hearers. Such was the path of Rabbi Jesus when he told his parables, his teaching stories. Stories that make no sense knock us right out of our comfort zone. They challenge our complacency. They invite us on a journey that is just as important as the destination. They shout rather than whisper. And today, to open this sermon series, which will touch on challenging and surprising and confounding stories from around the world, we begin with a story from Rabbi Jesus. The Gospel of Luke, in fact, does tell a quite lovely parable of the wedding feast, in which everyone is invited and no one is kicked out, and the moral of the story is that God's tent is big enough for all of us, and I love that story. I get that story. But that's not the story we're working with today, because that would be too easy. As you've heard, the Gospel of Matthew tells it a different way. I know, big surprise. Different version of the same stories appear all over the Bible, usually with enormous discrepancies between them. Nobody is quite sure if Luke's nice and comfy version is right, or Matthew's is wrong, or, as my personal favorite scholarly opinion on this story goes, if Jesus just believed that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, and chose to tell two versions for two different audiences. We don't know. But what I do know is that the Matthew version I read to you this morning has always made me mad. That's why I've challenged myself to live with it for a time and to bring it to you to see if that story, even when I have so long been uncomfortable with, can challenge my assumptions and teach me something if I just dare not to run away from it. You've heard the story now. The man invites the paupers from the street into his wedding feast, and when one person accepts the invitation but comes without being properly dressed, the rich guy kicks him out on the street. For years, I did not find anything to get in that story. And the truth of it is that it's probably some elaborate allegory for the Roman Empire that contains within it some deep, confusing theological assumptions on the part of the early Christian community. Those aspects of the story are interesting and important, but for my part, I wanted to live with the story until it had some message and meaning for my life. This is the challenge I want to offer to all of us. It is, in this way, a spiritual exploration rather than an intellectual one, and I'm inviting you to join me on it. Sometimes, it's the riddle that we need the most. And sometimes if we cannot stand a story or a person or an aspect of our lives, it is at least in part because it has something important to teach us. So, let me tell it again. The parable of the wedding feast, a story that makes no sense, in an effort to explore rather than run away, to journey rather than hide. If Jesus could tell two versions, I figure I can tell my own version. So here you have it, the parable of the wedding feast, Nancy's version. The old man never did have many friends in town. He wasn't even sure if his own family liked him. Lord knows his son didn't, not even now. On the day of his great big bash of a wedding feast, the boy could hardly even bring himself to look at him. Maybe it was because the old man was everything he didn't want to be. Maybe it was because the boy had always been pampered enough to have aspirations of moral grandeur, hoping to live a life free of the trappings of money and materialism that so enveloped the father. Only a rich boy could dream of a life without things, could fantasize about going off the grid as if poverty were something glamorous and being destitute were a spiritual achievement. Only the son of the richest man in town could dream of such things, and the old man woke on the morning of the wedding knowing that on this day of all days, nothing that he could pay for would make his son happy. Nothing he could do would buy his love. He feared he had lost that long ago, perhaps when he worked those long, long hours in the boy's childhood, perhaps when he bought up all the houses in town, demolished them and built on top what had become the finest mansion in Judea. Perhaps it was when he turned out the families who had lived in those houses, or when he hired laborers from Rome because the locals could never do the kind of fine artistry he wanted. Perhaps the boy stopped loving him all the way back when the old man first began, before all the sorrow and all the guilt, before all the people in the town started to hate him too. He did not know. But this feast was the one thing he could offer. Maybe it was the only thing he could do to tell the boy that he loved him. Perhaps it was not enough, or not what the boy wanted, but it was what he could do. So he had fattened the finest calves, and he had brought in the most beautiful oxen. Women had been gathering flowers by the armful for days so that they might bedeck the tables, and wine would flow from a fountain that never stopped pouring. There would be gifts and dancing and a tent of the finest linen to shade his beloved son's head. And though the old man could never find the words to tell the boy he loved him, that he always had, at least he could offer him this. And so he planned his party, and he decked his house, and he woke that morning that it would never be enough, knowing that at least he had tried. And when the hour of the wedding approached, the table was groaning under the food, and the fountain was humming with its sweet song, and the father waited in his finest robe for the guests to arrive, and he waited, and he waited, and he waited, and they did not come. Barnabas, it seemed, could not be wrestled from his farm. James, whom he only invited because he was on the town council, wouldn't leave his business dealings, and even his son's childhood friends said they could not come either. The man knew they did not come because they did not like him. They hated him for flaunting his wealth, for scorning the poor, for being so selfish. They hated him, and they would take it out on him by ruining this one day. So he sent out his servants far and wide to the country all around to beg the townspeople to come. Just do this one thing for me, though I do not deserve it. Just make this one day special. Just someone come. And the townspeople, many of whom had lost their homes when he built his great home, took his servants and put them to death, and the old man responded with the last of his old fierce anger. And still there was no one. And still he could not do even one thing right for his son. And still there was nothing he could do to make up for all he had done and all that he still did to this town. And he begged the last of the people who were on the streets, most of them paupers, to come in, no matter who they were, to his home. He begged them to gather for the feast, this last effort to do one decent thing. And finally, many people came, not because they loved him or because they were his friends, or because they knew anything of him or his son, but because they were hungry and there was food. The man, eager to give his son one decent gift, offered to dress the beggars in his finest clothes, to give them his own gold rings to wear on their hands. And when the guests were dressed and seated, the festival began. The bride was radiant and the groom was handsome. And when the boy walked out to the wedding grounds, he looked at his father with astonishment. Here finally was proof that his father perhaps was not all bad. All these people, he thought, must care about the old man in spite of it all, must care about the family. They have come and they are dressed so finely, and perhaps there is hope for us all yet. Maybe he cares, and maybe, just maybe, someone cares for him. The old man saw the hope in the boy's eyes, and he was calm for the first time in many years. In spite of it all he had done and all he had failed to do, at least he could give the boy this. Even if it all melted away at midnight, he could give him this one thing. These were the old man's thoughts of gratitude, of thanksgiving unto God for one day when things at least appeared lovely. Until his eye landed in one frightful moment on the form of one old beggar who stood at the buffet table, plate in hand, wearing scraps of clothing and streaked in mud, sticking out like a sore thumb in a sea of glittering robes and jeweled fingers. A stab of fear gripped the rich old man as he moved toward the tattered old beggar. "Get out of my house," the old man said, "and for the love of God, stand out in the darkness where the people cannot see you." For on that day, if only that day, he wanted to make something beautiful. Let's just say that the wedding feast is a metaphor for the kingdom of heaven or the path of righteousness or the way or some such thing. Let's just say for now that the mournful father is God, whose works have brought pain and whose designs too often come to naught, whose precious children, that would be us, cannot bring ourselves to look upon his face. Let's just say these things, whether or not we believe them, just for a minute. Let's just say that the way is laid out before so many people who refuse the invitation to walk a straight and loving path, that the banquet is spread before so many who do nothing but scorn its abundance. The banquet of life, the beautiful feast, is made available finally to all of us, every last hungry beggar, no matter what we believe or do not believe, no matter the wrong we have done or not done. The beauty is on display. The glory is for the taking. The trees change their colors in autumn, not just for the invited guest, but for everyone. And the world is pulsing with meaning and hope, and it is cast before us all. All of the goddesses' wide open arms are spilling out blessing if we would but accept it. The table is set. The abundance is before us. All the world wants to do is offer up her blessing, and all we have to do is show up ready to receive them. All we have to do is dress for the party, because on this day, if only this day, no matter how he may have let us down in the past, God's trying to make something beautiful here. How often do we all arrive on the pulse of a brand new day expecting something marvelous to happen? How often do we ask ourselves if we are really prepared for that marvel should it arrive? Have we put on the garment of gratitude or just the filthy old rags of expectation and entitlement? Have we clothed ourselves in openness, ready to receive, or are we draped in our own bitterness, angry that life is not what we planned for it to be? Are my shoulders draped in the finery of humility or the rags of self-righteousness? I lived with this story for a while, until I realized even this story I hate so much did have something to teach me. That the feast is laid out before us. It is open to all, and yet it still asks something of us in return. Just because we Unitarian Universalists believe that the way of truth and love and light is available to every human being, regardless of their race, their creed, or their gender, does not mean we can show up for the feast of life ill-prepared and expect still to be fed. Even a hostess who invites absolutely everybody to her table asks something in return from her guests. Readiness, willingness, gentleness, polite conversation. A commitment to showing up ready for the feast, dressed in our very best clothes, so that heaven and earth and nature and God can lay out the food before us, and we might actually be prepared to eat it and to participate in the making of a beautiful thing. That's what this difficult story said to me. That I have to show up for this free and abundant and beautiful journey, clothed in hope and wrapped in readiness, willing to be fed instead of insistent on being starved. This story, which makes no sense, ended up reminding me that I have to get out of bed every day willing and ready to be transformed. What stories make no sense to you? When are the good guys and the bad guys all mixed up and the moral of the story all hard to find? I invite you, in this series of sermons, to live with the stories you cannot stand for a time. Don't run away and see what even a story that makes no sense might have to teach for you as well. May it be so. Thank you.